2 years I was having a really hard time, like, with all the memories, but I really didn't want to lose the house either. Like, I had a big attachment to the house.
Yeah.
My brother, Pat, that helps me with the house a lot, really wanted us to move into the house and keep the house and all the traditions.
Yeah.
Carolyn er en exceptionel case i den forstand, at hun jo har arvet et hus, og på den måde ikke er lige så økonomisk ustabil som mange andre uden et arbejde i USA. Hun henter, siger hun jo, altså helt klart værdighed i det her med at passe sit hus. Men hun forhandler også hele tiden med, at det ikke er lige så godt, som hvis hun havde et rigtigt arbejde. Det er hele tiden det, der ligesom er den normative klangbund, at værdighed er det at have et lønnet arbejde, og så bakser hun lidt rundt derfra.
Du lytter til en videnskab.dk-podcast i samarbejde med Roskilde Universitet og Veluxfonden med støtte fra Carlsberg Mindelegat.
Hvad vil det sige at leve et liv med værdighed? Det er ikke nemt at svare på, for værdighed er abstrakt. Det er svært at tage at føle på, men alligevel mærker vi det tydeligt, når det mangler, når vi føler os uværdige. Jeg hedder Benjamin De Souza, og jeg er podcastredaktør på videnskab.dk. I den her podcastserie, så følger vi en gruppe forskere fra RUC, der undersøger, hvad værdighed og uværdighed egentlig er for noget. Vi skal med dem på deres feltstudie, hvor de har fulgt en gruppe personer igennem et år. Personer, hvis stemmer ofte bliver overhørt. De bor i udkanten, geografisk og socialt. Gennem scener fra hverdagen lytter vi til deres livshistorier, og vi hører forskernes overvejelser om, hvordan værdighed og uværdighed konkret viser sig. Hvordan værdigheden hænger sammen med noget sådan helt basalt menneskeligt, der findes i os alle. I den her episode skal vi til North Adams, Massachusetts i USA, hvor PhD og forsker Mark Joseph Connerton møder den 60-årige Carolyn. Carolyn har arvet et hus, som måske spørger lidt. Men det vil Mark fortælle mere om, for han har nemlig været der.
Carolyn is a quiet woman in her early 60s. With her mousy brown hair that she keeps in a ponytail under a green baseball cap that's pulled down low, it sometimes seems like she's trying to stay hidden. Despite her shyness, however, we warmed to each other and slowly built a friendship. I soon realized, too, that Carolyn doesn't want to stay hidden. Quite the opposite. She is actually someone who more likely wants to be recognized for her artistic talents, the many hours that she spends volunteering at a local food project, and for her home. They say home is where the heart is, and Carolyn pours her heart into her house. As I came to learn over time, Carolyn's relationship to her homestead is not only positive, but one of mixed feelings. I was curious about the way that she spoke about her moving back to North Adams and this house where she grew up. She mentioned several times that the interior has a particular essence, a piece of history that almost takes the form of a character in the scene of her everyday life, a character that inspires her and sometimes upsets her. We are speaking in the library of the First Congregational Church on Main Street in North Adams. It's also home to the Berkshire Food Project, a volunteer-run initiative that provides hot meals and groceries to anyone who's hungry or just doesn't want to eat alone. In order to get to know people in a community I was brand new in, I started to help out in the kitchen, preparing food, serving lunch, and chatting to volunteers and diners. I first met Caroline here, as we both manned the salad station, handing out small brown bowls of iceberg salad drenched in dressing. And we had just finished one of our shifts together. She's sitting across the library's large table, still wearing her cap and apron. In between talking to me, she takes regular sips from her aluminium water bottle, which she always has to hand.
Since I moved here 6 years ago, I have not been employed.
Yeah.
I think a reason I'm not is because I'm kind of managing this house and taking care of it. And, well, it's kind of private, but I came across of inheritance,
yeah.
So I don't have to work, but I Okay. I'm a little worried about that because it's not, I don't really know how much money it really is.
Yeah. And,
but I'm really frugal about spending, and the house is paid for.
Yeah.
And, but now it's kind of bothering me a little bit that I'm not working.
In what way?
And I think I miss, I was an art teacher.
Okay.
In Amherst.
And, yeah.
And I miss that a lot. Like, even if I went back to part-time, it would be, make me feel better, be doing what I always enjoyed doing there. And I thought when I came here, made the choice to come here, I would do it. But then
yeah.
I kind of started taking care of the house.
Carolyn talks a lot about her house, but in a way I found intriguing. She talks about it as if it has a particular spirit, as if it is a piece of history that almost takes the form of a living, breathing character in the scene of her everyday life. But as I came to learn, Carolyn's relationship to this house is one of much ambivalence.
There was a lot to do,
yeah.
Cleaning it out, and needed a lot of repairs because my parents were old and they weren't fixing things.
Yeah.
And okay. So it was like really a full-time job.
Okay.
And then by the second year, I was getting tired of being home all the time, taking care of that house and not really being in the community. And I had some friends here from high school that I still keep in touch with, only two, but they're also busy with their lives, so I didn't see a whole lot of them. So by 2018 of June, I started working here as a volunteer and enjoying it because I was meeting people and I was out of the house and I felt like useful and like it was a job but not pay. But now lately it's bothering me a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not employed, and my brothers are all still working, except for one.
Yeah.
He's retired. He retired a year ago, but I think he was even having difficulty with his retirement.
Yeah.
Like he didn't know what to do with his time.
Yeah.
Carolyn's case might not be what springs to mind when you think of unemployment. She inherited her house, and as a result, unemployment hasn't caused her huge financial insecurity. For her, unemployment causes issues other than financial, like questions of fulfillment and regularly seeing people that affirm her, like one might get in a work situation. The feeling of being recognized for the work that you do, whether through your monthly paycheck or praise for a job well done, that's what brought her to her volunteering position. Carolyn thinks of her weekly shifts helping at the food project as a job, which she shows up to almost without fail from Tuesday till Friday, always taking Mondays off for herself. Just like how she often refers to her home as another one of her jobs. Despite her being unemployed, she manages to have many jobs. How these non-paid jobs are recognized, however, is of course quite different to paid labor.
And would you put more worth than on paid work than volunteer work here? Is that why you would like to go back to work rather than this volunteer work?
Yeah, I would like a paid job.
Do you think that there's more, not prestige, but more worth to like a paid job than volunteering here? Or what would you get out of it more?
Right now, I guess yes, because I don't know. That's kind of where my mindset is, that I would like to be back to working. And I've been here a long time, and I'm a regular, like Bob Bicknett.
Yeah.
We're here a lot, like 3 or 4 days a week, more than a lot of people.
The volunteer position is a place where Carolyn gets recognition. A poster in the kitchen lists her as having donated the third highest number of hours to the project. It's in the high hundreds. But is this recognition enough?
I felt the same after a week here, and I was like sort of getting bored and restless and coming here and like structured to the day and meeting people. A natural way of meeting people as well was really nice.
Yeah, and it's super friendly. I mean, all the people are, I like everybody that's here. It can make for a long day if you're, you know, home all
day. Yeah.
It's like, I mean, I could still be cleaning that house out today, but
really?
I had enough.
So volunteering is a way for Carolyn to feel useful and worthy, but it's also a way for her to get out of the house. I always thought that the house represented A place where Carolyn can feel comfortable and at ease, despite her unemployment. But at times, she drops these hints that the relationship is not so straightforward. It slowly revealed to me that I haven't quite fully figured out what the house represents to Carolyn. Once, while sweeping the floors of the emptied-out church hall after the diners had left, she talked about how eager she is to show me her home. How other people enjoyed the house was something she often remarked upon. Some even described it as something of a museum, a characterization she wasn't fully comfortable with. From early on, I knew I had to see the place for myself.
Så står jeg i studiet på videnskab.dk sammen med forskningslederne Magnus Poulsen Hansen og Sabina Puls. Og vi følger her forskeren Mark, som er draget til North Adams i USA, hvor han møder Carolyn, en kvinde i start 60'erne, som har arvet et hus, og lige nu er frivillig for et sted, der serverer varm mad til folk, der har brug for det. Men hvad er Carolyn for et menneske? Hvorfor er hun en spændende case?
Carolyn er en exceptionel case i den forstand, at hun jo har arvet et hus, og på den måde ikke er lige så økonomisk ustabil som mange andre uden et arbejde i USA. Hun er samtidig en kvinde, som på forskellig vis ligesom fylder hverdagen ud med andre aktiviteter end et lønnet arbejde. Hun har sit hus, som hun bruger rigtig meget tid på at vedligeholde, og så er hun frivillig. Begge de ting omtaler hun sådan lidt som... Det føles som et fuldtidsarbejde, men det er ikke et rigtigt arbejde. Og i den forstand, så henter hun ligesom anerkendelse i forskellige andre aktiviteter, både i huset og i frivillig arbejde. Men hun forhandler også hele tiden med, at det ikke er lige så godt, som hvis hun havde et rigtigt arbejde. Det er hele tiden det, der ligesom er den normative klangbund, at værdighed er det at have et lønnet arbejde, og så bakser hun lidt rundt derfra.
Normativ klangbund, det må du lige fortælle mig, hvad er.
Normativ klangbund er ligesom den sociale konvention, der rammesætter, hvad er det, vi tillægger værdi, hvad giver status i vores samfund. Der er det lønnede arbejde bare en af de primære kilder til værdighed. Og det hele tiden det, hun forhandler op imod. Hun gør jo noget andet. Hun prøver at finde indhold og mening osv. i andre aktiviteter. Men hun har også hele tiden den her ambivalens i forhold til, men er det nu også rigtigt, eller er det ikke helt rigtigt? Og bliver hun nu også set nok, eller gør hun ikke det?
Når jeg tænker på personer, som arbejder frivilligt, om det er en fodboldtræner i den lokale fodboldklub, eller en pensionist, som arbejder en dag om ugen i en Røde Kors genbrugsbutik, så forbinder jeg det med en form for overskud. Altså at man lægger noget overskud ind i frivilligheden. Fornemmer I det samme overskud her i forhold til Carolyn?
Det man kan sige, det er jo, at givet hendes økonomiske situation omkring det her hus og så videre, så er alt arbejde jo på en eller anden måde frivilligt for hende. Eller hvad man siger. Hun har i hvert fald muligheden for at vælge det fra. Så derfor er grænsefladerne mellem det traditionelle lønarbejde og det såkaldt frivillige arbejde måske ikke så stor for Carolyn, som det er for andre. Men jeg synes, at det viser til gengæld noget andet, en anden spænding i hendes oplevelse af værdighed i forhold til arbejde. Der er en eller anden spænding og forhandling hos hende omkring, hvad hun gerne selv vil, og det at opnå værdighed gennem at lave det, man er dygtig til. Og så, hvordan hun tror, at andre ser på hendes værdighed, kan man sige. Ikke?
Altså det der med, at hun ikke får penge for det? Eller?
Ja, altså det er både det amerikanske og det danske samfund jo kendetegnet ved, at vi ser meget det traditionelle lønarbejde som sådan den hovedkilden til at opnå værd i vores samfund. Ikke? Så det er også på en eller anden måde noget, hun internaliserer, og noget, hun så skal forhandle omkring, hvad der er det værdige arbejde i hendes situation. På nogle måder er det også lidt afspejlet hendes forhold til huset, fordi det er også noget, hun har sådan et flertydigt forhold til, og hvor hun også på den ene side bor i det, på den anden side, så er hun også opmærksom på, hvordan andre synes, at det her hus, det opfattes.
Carolyn fortæller jo netop, at hun har arvet det her hus, som er så betalt ud. Altså, hun har ikke brug for at arbejde for penge, siger hun lige ud, men stadigvæk siger hun, at det bother hende, altså det nager hende. Hvorfor gør det det?
Jamen, det er fordi, hun lidt er på kanten af at leve op til det, man skal leve op til som borger i et samfund, hvor det er enormt at være selvforsørgende. Hun har også en mand, som er blind, og de får nogle ydelser igennem hans situation, Så hun er heller ikke fuldstændigt fri neoliberal agent, der bare klarer mosten selv på grund af sin arv. Altså der er sådan stadigvæk en eller anden form for, at hun lidt er udlejret i et system, der hjælper hende. Og på den måde er hun jo på kant med nogle af de mest sådan væsentlige normer. Der er også en anden ting ved hende. Altså hun henter, siger hun jo, altså helt klart værdighed i det her med at passe sit hus og også i sit frivillige arbejde. Men værdighed er jo heller ikke kun en ren følelse. Det er jo ikke kun, den står ikke alene. Den er typisk i sådan et, hvad kan man sige, følelsesmæssigt landskab lige ved siden af rigtig mange andre følelser. Og hos Carolyn, så ser vi jo det her med, at hendes værdighed er lige tæt på ambivalensen, og den er måske også...
Hvor ser du det?
Jamen, i det her med, at hun på nogle tidspunkter netop kalder det, at det er ligesom et fuldtidsarbejde. Og så på andre tidspunkter i samtalerne med Mark, så kommer det frem, ej, det er alligevel ikke helt nok. Der er stadigvæk en eller anden længsel, eller et eller andet, der ikke er forløst. Så det bor rigtig tæt på hinanden hos Carolyn. Og en anden ting er, at hun er enormt nostalgisk. Så nostalgien sidder også lige ved siden af værdigheden for Carolyn.
Og nu skal vi så tilbage til historien. Forskeren Mark skal på besøg i Carolyns hus. Et hus, som har stor betydning for hende, og som måske spøger lidt. Men hvor går grænsen mellem at have en forskningsrelation og så et venskab?
A few months later, and after a trip home, I am back in North Adams, and have finally had a chance to visit Carolyn in her home. This feels like a huge moment in building the relationship with Carolyn as a research participant and friend. After a shift at the food project and taking some time to write up some field notes in the nearby public library, I take the 15-minute walk on a day with pristine blue skies, but a temperature that hasn't risen above freezing all day. I arrive to Carolyn's impressive white wooden home of three stories, built in 1900, and I knock on the shuttered door. Carolyn welcomes me, and I take in the old-school feeling of the interior. There is lots of floral wallpaper and wood paneling on the walls. After greeting me, Carolyn takes me on a tour of the many rooms of the house. She first shows me through her immaculately decorated dining room. One wall is covered in art and photographs that together form a sort of impressive tapestry, and I notice that the dinner table has already been set for dinner later that evening. As we move through the sitting room, the Christmas tree still standing in the corner also gives me a feeling of time out of place, as it is late February. Then we climb upstairs.
And was the wallpaper the same when you stayed here?
No.
No.
I took off the wallpaper. This was beneath it. But I really liked this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't get all of it off. I don't know. It wasn't anything special what was on here, but it was kind of a little floral pattern. Yes. A lot of work.
Yeah, and he says before it's maybe like your full-time job.
Oh yeah, it easily could be.
Yeah.
Easily could be.
Here is an example of the unfolding relationship Carolyn has with her house. She shows me around the place with real pride and nostalgia. One closet in an upstairs room still contains the childhood toys she and her brothers played with as children. But the things left in the house by her childhood and by her parents are also a source of unending work to sort through, and they've left some ghosts in the house. I come to learn that Carolyn is somewhat caught between keeping the past alive through the maintenance of the house and the family traditions associated with the space, and also her desire to revamp the place and project herself and the house into the future.
My ice skates need to be sharpened.
Yeah.
And then, oh, this is all old wallpaper up there.
Oh, yeah. Some extra stuff you need to do any repairs.
Yeah, there's so much stuff here still. Mm-hmm. The first 2 years, like pre-COVID, I really cleaned this out. Like my bedroom, you couldn't even get in.
Really?
It was... That's just so easy to just shove crap in a room and close the door. And
yeah.
No, I'm not kidding you. I had to go through it and Then I went through 10 closets, and I have two more to do, and I'll be done. But
childhood homes have been described by psychologists as strange and intense spaces that represent other worlds for people when they return to them. Carolyn has had to work through a huge amount of stuff related to her childhood and parents when re-establishing the house space as her own. But lots of it appears to be just how it was in her childhood. The task has been time-consuming and intense for her, and understandably crops up quite often when I speak to her. I get a sense of relief from Carolyn when she tells me that there are only two closets left to sort through. The 6 years of clearing through her parents' belongings in the house seem to be for her as much of a mental hurdle as a physical undertaking. I start to understand why the house is like a living, breathing character. Then as we climb a second staircase to the attic rooms, I learn my place in the house amongst the memories of the past.
Do you want to stay up in this room or?
On this field trip, I'm staying at the bed and breakfast of a friend I made at the food project. A 40-minute walk out of town, with the hourly bus service last running at 7 p.m. Carolyn's partner, Bob, has prepared a Mardi Gras dinner of jambalaya and gumbo for that evening, so Carolyn kindly offers for me to stay over in her spare room. Research like this, in private and intimate settings, demands a careful balance between the roles of researcher and friend. The evening is ticking by, and it's dark and freezing outside.
It's pretty nice, yeah, maybe it could be nice, yeah.
There's just no bathroom and no TV, I don't know if you...
I probably manage without a TV.
Okay.
Yeah, that's okay.
I'll turn the heat on.
Okay.
There are more blankets here.
Okay.
But it's really awesome for sleeping and having privacy.
Yeah, right. Even if it's a bit, I don't mind it when it's a little bit chillier for sleeping.
After enjoying the delicious seafood feast with Carolyn and Bob, and relaxing together over beers and stories of their lives together, I retire to the heavily wallpapered attic room, which is dominated by a huge painting by Carolyn's mother. It shows an uneasy blue sea. Through the night, I listen to the groaning radiators and chattering plumbing of the old house. From my time in Carolyn's place, I begin to get a sense of why the place feels so alive, like a character in her life. Its old charm is carefully kept alive, with most of the old furnishings and decoration that was in place when her parents passed away. But it's also where she enjoys meals with Bob, and entertains old friends of hers from the neighborhood and farther afield. I can understand her misgivings about others characterizing it as a museum. Keeping the house like this is about keeping memories and traditions alive, not only for herself, but also for her brothers and extended family. And there's dignity in that for Carolyn. I leave in the morning, eager to find out what meaning Carolyn derives from her deep attachment to the past. A couple of months later, I'm back in Denmark in between field trips. Although I'm an ocean away, it's really important to maintain my relationship with the research participants. To keep it both fun and fruitful, I ask my participants to send me photographs of things in their everyday life that mean something to them, and then we call to talk about why. With the help of her friend, Carolyn has sent me a series of photos that capture things that she finds meaningful on a random day in her life. Things that give her a sense of dignity or indignity. It's a great way for us to spark rich conversations while I'm not there with her. If what you are about to hear sounds like we are chatting through an old school landline telephone, that's because we are. Carolyn couldn't join the video call I set up due to her struggle with technology that she readily admits to. Sometimes I feel like this struggle compounds her fear of being too old to find a job again. She describes a photograph of a painting that she painted when she was younger. The painting depicts a snake moving through long grass with another little bug as company. She originally painted it as part of a set of illustrations that she had planned for a children's book. an idea she once held as a possible career path that would allow her to invest in her artistic talents. And,
are there then specific emotions that you associate with that picture?
Not really. That was really my favorite picture of the entire book. Mm-hmm. I think that's why I saved it. And then I ended up selling it to this couple that live in Rockport, Mass, where my family would vacation in summers. And the connection was that my roommate at the time was his sister and brother-in-law lived in Rockport. And I don't know, somehow they saw my artwork. I don't know how, it was so long ago, but mm-hmm. they really liked this painting and they bought it. Like I said, it's probably my favorite of all the paintings in that book. And it's, you know, whimsical and joyous and mm-hmm. fun. And mm-hmm. I think the quality of my work was probably the best. But I'm judging it right now. I don't like that little crown I put on top of the snake's head.
I think it's kind of fun. It makes the snake almost part of the grass.
A little kid's book, very learning to count, so very young.
And would the publishing of children's books, would that have been a career choice that you were looking into, or was it something that you're just trying out, or how did you approach that?
Oh, it was both. I really wanted to land a job with a big publishing house like Simon & Schuster or somebody like that, and do that as my profession. I kind of gave up on it, and it's extremely difficult and competitive. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Holly Hobby. Probably not.
No.
Sometimes I notice that Carolyn changes the subject when the topic approaches something she finds difficult.
So was selling your art a thing on the side that you had, a side hustle, or was it ever a main source of your income?
I was always working a job, full-time job, something I didn't care for.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was pretty focused on my art. I was doing a lot of my art back then, and I had an artist studio up in Leverett, and I was pretty active in the community, and I participated in art shows and, whenever I had the chance, and try to sell my work. And so I kept that going for a while, but it got expensive and I just wasn't making ends meet. But I would like to get back to my art. I really haven't done any since I moved here. Aside from working my garden, which I see as art, trying to make it look nice, and arranging plants where they should be, and flowers, and taking good care of it.
I noticed some traces of disappointment in Carolyn. Since you talked about your garden, she's reminiscing on another way her life could have taken. That you sent me next. Her early dreams of working as an illustrator ended up in her working, as she terms it, crummy jobs. However, the hopes and aspirations tied up in this dream did not simply fade away into the past. They are still alive in the way that Carolyn builds a sense of self-worth, even today. The recognition of having sold her painting as a younger woman has stuck with her through all this time. While the path of living from her art did not transpire, she has taken the artistic impulse with her, and now spends a creative energy on tending to her garden and the upkeep of the old house. In the way that she showed me her house and garden, and from the way the old children's illustrations stay important to her, it's clear to me that recognition for these pursuits is important for Carolyn. She also tells me how it is a way for her to honor her parents, or at least recognize what they gave to her. However, recognition is not always easy to come by, and to give. It can be hard to recognize someone when you don't have a full picture of their lives. Something I too only realized as I began to get a fuller picture of Carolyn's life.
Mark tager os med på en tur i Carolyns hus. En stor, gammel, rustik sag. Og Mark beskriver det som om, at huset nærmest har sin egen levende karakter. Han ender med at overnatte dig. Nu ligger det simpelthen lige for at spørge. Er det normalt for forskere, som arbejder med feltstudier, som I gør, at man overnatter hos dem, man undersøger?
Nej, det er nok ikke normalt, og der er heller ikke nogen af de andre forskere, Maggie og Wally, der har gjort det. Men på den anden side, så hvorfor ikke? Fordi udgangspunktet her er jo at forstå hverdagen og deres liv i sin helhed. Og fordi at det her hus betyder så meget for Carolyn, så giver det også forskningsmæssigt mening for Mark at blive i det og prøve at mærke, hvordan det føles at være i det her sted her. Så på den måde, nej, ikke normalt, men det giver virkelig god mening i det her tilfælde.
Mark fortæller i scenen, "This feels like an important moment in building the relationship with Carolyn as a research participant and friend." Altså at han siger, at han er ved at opbygge en relation til Carolyn som både en medvirkende til det her forskningsprojekt, men også en ven. Kan man godt opbygge et venskab og stadigvæk forholde sig fagligt til de medvirkende?
Altså det er jo helt klart nogle krævende balancer at skulle navigere i, både som forsker og som deltager. Men den der modstilling, der tidligere, hvad kan man sige, har været i forhold til at kigge på deltagere i forskningsprojekter næsten som objekter, selvom de er mennesker, er måske i virkeligheden også lidt underlig. Det, der selvfølgelig vokser frem, når man laver sådan noget arbejde, hvor Mark i det her tilfælde følger Carolyn igennem længere tid, jamen det er jo, at de også lærer hinanden at kende, og det vil også på en måde være kunstigt at gå imod, hvad kan man sige, de impulser, der opstår, når man lærer folk at kende.
Hvilket ansvar har man som forsker i sådan en relation? Altså, jeg kan forestille mig, at der er en lidt sådan ubalanceret magtbalance.
Ja, der er i hvert fald et udgangspunktet en relation, hvor at Mark skal have noget information ud af Carolyn, og Carolyn som sådan ikke får noget ud af relationen. Der er selvfølgelig også en magtbalance eller et magtforhold i forhold til, at Mark er forsker og højt uddannet og kommer som den eksperten i det her, og Carolyn er deltager og skal levere input til det, men hun er jo ikke med til at definere, hvad det er, for forskningsprojektet handler om osv. Så der er et eller andet på spil der, som man bliver nødt til at forholde sig til. Og der er jo det på spil, at når vi har et projekt, hvor vi bygger det på, at vi bliver nødt til at forstå de her personers følelser og den kontekst, som de her følelser de udfolder sig i. Og følelser er jo tit også noget, vi forbinder med nære relationer og venskab. Så det vil sige, at vi bygger nogle bånd. Og det giver jo på en eller anden måde et ansvar. Ikke nødvendigvis, at vi står og skal hjælpe Carolyn i alt, hvad hun laver, men det, når man bygger en relation op, så har man også et ansvar for at følge den til dørs og tænke over, hvordan skal vi slutte den her relation. På et eller andet tidspunkt, så skal vi ligesom sige, nu er forskningsprojektet slut, og så er det jo op til både Mark og Carolyn at finde ud af, hvad giver mening for dem i forhold til, om den her relation den skal fortsætte, og er Carolyn interesseret i at høre resultaterne fra projektet? Det er hun måske, det er hun måske ikke, osv. Så der er alle de her spørgsmål, som man bliver nødt til at stille sig i forhold til, at hvis man bare gik ud og interviewede en person, og så var det ligesom det, så har vi nu etableret et bånd, som vi bliver nødt til at tænke over, hvordan at vi skal føre videre eller ikke føre videre, efter projektet er slut.
Er det normalt, at når man laver de her feltstudier, ligesom etablerer et venskab efterfølgende? Sker det?
Det er ikke uhørt, altså overhovedet, og der er nogen, der har relationer, der går dekader tilbage. Det er også, hvad kan man sige, de virkelig langsigtede forskere. Men nej, altså det her med, som Magnus så fint snakker om, altså det her bånd, der er mellem forskeren og deltagerne, altså i virkeligheden så installerer det jo bare en opmærksomhed på etik, som altid burde være der. Så den måde,
hvad mener du med det?
Jamen, at vi aldrig jo bør behandle andre mennesker helt instrumentelt og bare plukke information ud af dem og i øvrigt være ligeglad med, hvor den information går hen, eller hvilke konsekvenser osv. den har. Der er jo altid en etisk relation, når man beder mennesker om at deltage i forskning.
Advokerer du så for, at man bør opbygge et venskab med
Ikke nødvendigvis. Det kommer helt an på kemien, og det ser også enormt forskelligt ud med de deltagere, der er her i vores, i vores projekt. Det er langt fra alle, der laver venskaber, men det er jo, når kemien er der, er til det. Og det er heller ikke til at sige, ligesom hvad udfaldet på længere sigt er. Men jeg er helt sikker på, at undervejs så har det været rare for både Mark og Carolyn, at der var sådan en varme og en tillid og en god relation, som de har formået at bygge op. Og så er der jo også det ved det, at ingen af dem går jo hjem fra det arbejde. Så det er også krævende for forskeren ligesom ikke at sige, nå, men det var så til klokken 4 arbejder, og så var det det.
Her også sover han jo rent faktisk derude, ikke?
Her sover han derude, og kontakten foregår også tit, fordi der er tidsforskel fra hvor Carolyn bor til hvor Mark opholder sig noget af det her fællesstudie. Altså, så taler han med hende klokken 10-11 om aftenen og sådan. Altså, der er nogle andre balancer, man også som forsker skal lære at navigere i. Det er krævende for begge parter, men forhåbentlig også desto mere givende, fordi at de også får lov til ligesom deltagerne og tone projektet i den forstand, at det er jo deres situerede oplevelse af værdighed, som vi lærer fra.
Situerede oplevelse, hvad betyder det?
Jamen, at vi ligesom står med dem i deres virkelighed, i deres hverdagsliv. Det er derfor, vi bygger viden. Det er jo ved at stå sammen med dem og kigge ud på, hvad det er for en verden, og hvad det er for en oplevelse af verden, de har.
Og hvad vil I sige til dem, der siger, at man ikke kan forholde sig objektivt til personer, som man har en relation til?
Jamen, der vil vi jo nok sige, at det er i udgangspunktet et almengyldigt problem, at det er meget svært, når man især beskæftiger sig med samfundsforskning, som beskæftiger sig med det samfund, som vi er en del af. Det vil sige, at det er meget svært at stå uden for det. Så den der objektive position, den er faktisk, tror jeg, fra vores perspektiv, i udgangspunktet umulig. Og især når vi snakker om værdighed. Vi kan ikke ligesom stå uden for de måder at forstå værdighed på og så videre, som der allerede er i samfundet. Så derfor så er det ikke den der rene objektive position, som vi leder efter. Men vi leder selvfølgelig efter at prøve at være systematiske og refleksive og nuanceret i vores forståelse af det her fænomen. Og vi prøver sådan set også på mange måder at bruge det til at blive klogere. Vi prøver at være nysgerrige, så vi prøver også at sætte vores egne forståelse af det her fænomen på spil i det, vi laver.
Jeg vil lige vende tilbage til historien. Vi slutter nemlig med at høre Carolyn beskrive et maleri, som hun malede i sin fortid. Der er noget stolthed og måske også noget vemod forbundet med den her beskrivelse. Eller hvad får I ud af den her scene?
Ja, altså for det første så lærer vi fra Carolyn det her med, at værdighed ikke kun er noget, der er mellem mennesker. Værdighed er også noget, der kan gro og vokse i omgivelser og i materielle objekter osv. Det kan knyttes til ting og steder snarere end kun andre mennesker. Og når hun viser det her billede frem som et eksempel på noget, der giver hendes liv indhold, så det er jo fordi hun har stadig kunstneriske aspirationer. Måske skal hun lige mindes om dem midt i alt sit frivillige arbejde og sin skab. Men når hun kigger på det der maleri, så kommer hun ligesom i kontakt med, og det resonerer i hende, at hun faktisk er kunstner. Så ikke bare for det hende til at sådan ligesom tænke over, hvordan hendes arbejdsliv har formet sig indtil nu. Det peger også på en eller anden måde fremad for hende, i hvert fald i det øjeblik. Og så ved jeg ikke, hvor lang tid det øjeblik lige varer. Men det er tydeligt, at der er noget på spil her, som betyder rigtig meget for hende, og at hun på et tidspunkt havde en drøm om at have et andet arbejdsliv, som ikke bestod af crummy jobs, som hun i virkeligheden ikke gik særlig meget op i, men ligesom kunne forløse sig selv som kunstner.
Alle vores deltagere, de forstærker på forskellige måder nogle aspekter af det her objekt, som vi undersøger omkring værdighedsoplevelser. Og Carolyn, bliver det her, hendes forhold til hendes hus, meget det her, den her relation til fortiden, og hvordan fortiden betyder noget for ens oplevelse af værdighed og uværdighed. Og det bliver sådan meget, meget konkret i Carolyns case, men det er jo stadig noget, vi alle sammen kan genkende på en eller anden måde, at vi har en idé om, at der var noget engang, der var godt eller skidt, og vores fremtidige og nutidige handlinger er på en eller anden måde noget, vi spejler i forhold til den her fortid. Og det bliver det her hus jo sådan et meget konkret eksempel på, hvordan det hele tiden minder Carolyn om, hvordan fortiden var i forhold til hendes nuværende situation.
Der er noget nostalgi forbundet med det hus der, både i forhold til hendes minder til barndommen, og den måde, hun ligesom har dekoreret det på. Og selvfølgelig, når man får den her beskrivelse af hendes maleri, så er det jo også tydeligt, at der er noget tilbage her. Og et andet liv, hun ligesom ser, eller en parallelt liv i en anden dimension, hun måske kunne have valgt. I snakker meget om det her med Carolyn, som jo på en eller anden måde også lidt lever i fortiden. Er det egentlig hensigtsmæssigt?
Leve i fortiden som ren nostalgi har sine åbenlyse problematikker, fordi at det betyder måske, at man ender med at glemme fremtiden og håbet og hvad man kan gøre lige nu, frem for at kigge bagud hele tiden. På den anden side, så er det jo helt essentielt, at man holder fortiden i live, at man holder minder i live, og at man baserer sin nuværende valg på, hvordan at man har haft det og oplevet fortiden. Så på den måde er det jo ikke... Vi har jo sådan en tendens til sådan at nedgøre lidt sådan nostalgien og det at kigge tilbage, men det er jo også virkelig vigtigt, at vi holder fortiden i live. Det er jo lidt den sådan flertydighed, som Carolyn er i. Altså blandet stolthed og lyst til at lave noget andet omkring hendes fortid. Ikke?
Der er også den dimension i det, at hun føler sig useful, som hun siger. Hun føler, at hun altså, bruger sig selv på en måde, som giver hende en eller anden form for værdi. Og at hun... Altså hun sidder jo ikke kun og reminiserer inde i sit eget hoved. Hun gør faktisk nogle praktiske ting ude i virkeligheden, som vedligeholder det her hus og muliggør, at hun år efter år inviterer til Thanksgiving og til Christmas lunch og det ene og det andet. Og hun gør det ikke kun for sig selv, men også for sin udvidede familie. Og det har jo også en kæmpe stor betydning. Så hvis det er ren nostalgi bagudrettet inde i dit eget hoved, jeg vil være mere skeptisk i forhold til livskvalitet, men det at kunne omsætte det på en måde, så det også bringer nogle nye oplevelser i spil, tror jeg, er ganske givende i hendes situation.
Tak til Magnus Paulsen Hansen og Sabine Puls for jeres input og analyser, og Mark og Carolyn her. Nu skal vi tilbage til afslutningen af historien om Carolyn. Mark, han har taget hen til det sted, hvor han mødte Carolyn for allerførste gang. Der er gået noget tid, og meget har forandret sig, siden de første gang mødte hinanden. Men der er også nogle ting, der forbliver de samme.
The seasons have changed, and the bracingly cold February has given way to a hot and sticky July. The once bare mountains around the town now almost look like dense jungles. Carolyn and I have returned to the church library after another volunteer shift at the food project. The kitchen and dining hall have been cleared away, and the church returns to quiet and solace, with the stained glass windows casting a technicolor light onto the dining tables. Outside, a summer rainstorm ferociously pelts the hot asphalt, and we're thankful for the dry, air-conditioned safety of this back room of the church, with walls adorned with inspirational religious messages. Carolyn, this time with her apron removed, but still with the baseball cap. The first time we talked in this room, almost a year ago, she sat across the large table from me. Now we sit side by side. We are speaking about a dream in which she relived her father's death, and the conversation has opened up to the trauma and loss that the house holds for her.
I think with these dreams, and I've had some other ones before, and which I never got into it with my doctor, but she's told me I had PTSD, and I've read about it a little bit, and I probably do, and it can resurface at any time, and I'm living in their house, and it's everything in there, everything is theirs, and I'm still cleaning it out, and I don't know, I've always been really sensitive, like, all my life, and like, I didn't even go to their, they didn't have funerals, but they had a, you know, just a private service at the cemetery, just with my family, my brothers, and I didn't even go, I just couldn't handle it.
Really?
Yeah, I was just too, I don't know, I had a really difficult time with it. And, yeah, I'm sure I do have PTSD. And the getting older thing, like, things can change, like your sleeping can get worse and all that. And
yeah.
So.
Of course. And being in the house and stuff, are the memories always like positive, or do you like memories that you associate with the house?
Yeah. I mean, there were nothing bad ever happened there. It was always positive. But I had, you know, when we had the option of moving there, and I didn't really want to come back here, and I had that thought of moving in that house again if I could handle it because of all the memories and all their stuff is in there, and you know, my brothers didn't do any cleaning out of anything, really. Not much.
Yeah. How did you get over that sort of or like sense of maybe being overwhelmed by all of the stuff and the memories that were there?
Well, I didn't I couldn't even clean out. My mother was a closet clothes person, and I couldn't even look at her stuff. It just reminded me of her and that her smell, and I don't know if it was on her sweaters, and I just left it in the closets for a couple of years.
Yeah.
The first 2 years I was having a really hard time, like, with all the memories, but I really didn't want to lose the house either. Like, I had a big attachment to the house.
Yeah.
I still have good friends here that stayed in North Adams that never went anywhere else. And my brother, Pat, that helps me with the house a lot, really wanted us to move into the house and keep the house and all the traditions and everything and take care of it. And
during this conversation, I realized the importance of this type of patient and slow research for allowing more complicated emotions to emerge from our interactions with each other. I also realized the difficult process of seeing and recognizing someone for how they want to be seen. I see that there are things that I too have failed to recognize until now during my time with Carolyn. The house, which I thought of as her safe space and somewhere of ease in her unemployment, has also always been a place of ambivalence. It is a place that represents her childhood attachments and memory, but also loss. Her decision to move back into the house after her parents passed wasn't entirely based upon her own interests, but also in the interest of her family, who wanted someone to maintain the place where they could come together to enjoy family dinners. It was also a deeply painful experience for Carolyn to return to the house, to the point where she doubted if she would be able to make the move at all. This doesn't mean that the place isn't somewhere of great meaning and comfort to her, and a source of recognition and dignity. But it is a relationship of complexity and ambiguity. Carolyn pours much of her life into the house. Like her artworks that she shows me, it's a way of keeping alive a more hopeful past, even if those possible past worlds have faded out of her future. Through good or through bad, the house represents a dignity for her in keeping the past alive. What does Carolyn's case tell us about unemployment? For me, her case shows us how unemployment causes people to ask questions of themselves. Where do I get a sense of worth from? How can I be recognized as a respected member of my community? These aren't necessarily questions you ask of yourself if you get those things through your place of work. Unemployment then becomes a moment of confrontation with yourself. It pushes people like Carolyn to seek and get recognition elsewhere, at home with family, volunteering at the local food project, or in the happy memories of the past.
Du har lyttet til De Uværdige. Hvis du har lyst til at høre flere afsnit, så ligger hele serien til dig på videnskab.dk's podcast feed. Og hvis du kunne lide den, så vil jeg sætte stor pris på, hvis du anmelder den og anbefaler den til dine nærmeste. Afsnittet er tilrettelagt af Ph.D. Mark Joseph Connerton og mig, Benjamin D'Souza. Og så er det produceret af Magnus Ringsborg Valbum. I studiet var forskningslederne fra projektet Indigma, Magnus Paulsen Hansen og Sabina Puls. Podcasten er blevet til i samarbejde med RUC og Velux-fonden og med støtte fra Carlsberg Mindelegat.